From the pages of Professional Investigator Magazine comes PI Magazine, the podcast. Join us each week for the latest in the world of the professional investigator. Exciting guests, new equipment, marketing tips, software, PI advice, and more. Learn what's new and exciting in PI Magazine, the podcast. Now let's join our host and the publishers of PI Magazine, Jim Nanos and Nicole Cusinelli.
And welcome everyone to this episode of PI Magazine, the podcast. I'm your co-host, Jim Nanos. I'm a licensed professional investigator based in Southern New Jersey and co-publisher of PI Magazine. We're broadcasting today from the PI Magazine podcast studios in beautiful Southern New Jersey. I'm usually joined by my co-host and co-publisher of PI Magazine, Nicole Cusinelli, but Nick was not able to get it into studio this evening, so I'm sort of flying solo today. Working the board today and hopefully pushing the right buttons is our good friend and PI Magazine contributor, Detective Jack Russell. Our guest today is Susan Constantine. Susan holds a master's of psychology and is the author and founder of Silent Messages. Susan brings the proven science of emotion recognition, body language reading, and deception detection to the legal and professional investigative world. Susan has more than 12 years experience analyzing jurors, witnesses, and suspects in high-profile cases, including Amanda Knox, Michael Jackson, George Zimmerman, Casey Anthony, Jerry Sandusky, Bill Cosby, and hundreds of other ones. Additionally, she has provided insights and analysis during media coverage of the past three presidential elections. I'll bet you that's something. Professionally, Susan has trained FBI and Homeland Security agents, the Department of Defense Inspector General, federal court judiciary, law judges, and attorneys in hundreds of private law firms. Susan is widely recognized as the world's leading authority on body language as it pertains to deception detection. Susan is also the author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Reading Body Language. Note to self, I'm going to buy a copy of that book for Jack Russell. And has been, for the past decade, the go-to source for media outlets analyzing the body language of public figures. Susan, welcome to PI Magazine, the podcast. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for inviting me.
We're honored to have you on the show today, and I apologize Nick's not able to be on the show this afternoon. This is the topic that I absolutely love. As you know, I'm a retired law enforcement, and reading body language and the language, nonverbal cues, is something that was always super interesting to me. It's something I found fascinating. So before we get into that, tell us a little about yourself and a little about your business.
I have a company that's called the Human Behavior Lab and also the Jury Lab. The Human Behavior Lab is a business that provides services and speaking engagements and training for anywhere from law enforcement to government agencies to corporate to the corporate world. The Jury Lab, which is my other company, is a technology that I had developed and patented that reads human emotion, which is used for mock trials and for focus groups. So in addition to that, I've been doing this since 2004. I started my career out as a trial consultant. I was selling the first AI solution, artificial intelligence solution, in the courtroom called the JuryQuest. And that was a technology that profiled jurors, whether they were more pro-defense or pro-prosecution. So that was kind of my intro into the world of reading people through profiling, through demographic factors. And then that took me into my own research about how can I better serve my clients to understand human behavior even more, helping them to deselect jurors. And that's what really got me excited about it, because I started doing my own research and came upon multiple articles on how to detect deception, how to read people. And I reached out to them. Dr. Paul Ekman Group, the HumanTel Group, investigative groups, J.J. Newberry. There was Richard Geiselman and cognitive interviewing. There was multiple names that were constantly being referred to. And I said, if I want to learn more about it, I want to learn from the best. And so that's when I reached out to them and then began training and teaching myself and then used it out. So I took the validated science and I vetted it out in the field. And that's how I got to know how to read people at the level that I'm at right now.
That's fascinating. So as a trial consultant or jury consultant, I guess initially, as you said, you were initially exposed to it. What were some of the things you would look at, or what were the situations you put in? Was it during the trial or during selection of a jury?
It was during the selection process. So before trial begins, each side is given the juror questionnaires of the jurors that, not chosen jurors, but jurors that are being brought in that we would question during voir dire. And each one of the questionnaires will tell you their demographic information, their age, their ethnicity, their level of occupation, level of education, if they've served on a jury before, if they have children. There's multiple different things that are on the juror questionnaire. And in some states, the attorneys agree on what goes into that juror questionnaire that is really important for that particular trial. So for this program in itself, there were seven demographic factors, which is age, ethnicity, occupation, level of education, if they've served on a jury before, if they have, you know, if they've come to a verdict. There were seven different demographic factors that we would look at. I would input all those demographic factors into the program. And then based on, it was like a computerized mathematical genius algorithm. And what they found is that there's been research studies with Walter Abbott and John Batt, who created what they call the analytic juror rater. Based on 23 different demographic factors, they had found that certain people with combined demographics vote one way or the other. So that was then created into a technology program that I would enter the data from each one of those juror questionnaires into the program, and it would tell me whether they tend to fall more pro-prosecution or pro-defense. So, and then there was an additional area in the program that was called subjective, meaning what did you observe? What did you hear? So then you can adjust the point system. So that's where I felt that that was a weak spot within the program, because they didn't know what to put in there. It was just based on what they heard, but they didn't know how to actually read people accurately. So that's what got me into more of my own research and finding out how can I better adjust those scores based on observances and what I hear them saying to give my attorney, who I'm hired by, the best, cleanest data. So that was done in the courtroom with the jurors in there as they're being questioned.
I often get retained by attorneys to go out and do a lot of criminal defense work, witness statements. I often have the attorneys, when I report back to them, I give them my written report. I always get, well, what do you think? What do you think about that witness or that person you took a statement from? And often we're asked to give an analysis based upon their reaction to the questions that we're asking in the field as to how we think they're responding, if they're being truthful, if they would quote unquote make a good witness or would not make a good witness. So it's, I can see the comparison to what you were doing, obviously in the jury room or in the courtroom, it's much different. But in our case, as professional investigators, we're often out in the field doing interviews and we really have to draw an opinion whether that person is being truthful. As a police officer, we did it all the time during statements, but as a PI, that's usually what we're out doing. So being able to pick up the signs of deception or maybe somebody being uncomfortable with the type of question you're asking, I can see where that would be very, very helpful to a professional investigator out in the field.
Kind of hitchhiking off from what you're talking about, in my work, I've also been used in that capacity as well, just to be a silent observer, just to be there, just to take in the information to determine whether that juror is telling the truth or not. Now, you have to keep in mind that, you know, what do they have at stake? You know, they're not the criminal here. They're not the one being that's on the stand or the defendant or the plaintiff. They have no skin in the game, or they don't have the skin in the game. But what we're looking for is there a hidden agenda? Do they have or harbor any biases that would be detrimental to your particular case? And you can hear that through the words that they use, through their behavior. For example, I remember one case in particular that the judge had made mention about, has anyone in here ever had an experience with law enforcement? And I saw this one guy that was in the gallery, and he had a short cut off sleeveless shirt, tattoos, and he just started getting really uneasy, squirming in his seat, scratching his face, appeared to be very nervous. So just based on that observation alone, I told one of the other attorneys, I said, do a quick background on this guy. I said, I think he's got a record. There's something to do with law enforcement. So just based on that demeanor alone, we nailed it, because there was domestic violence involved. And so that gave us reason why we saw the stimulus. Why was he anxious? And those are the things that we're looking at. And that's how we're looking at how we detect deception. We're looking at these pockets of anxiety based on the stimulus question, or the stimulus that's happening at that time. And then we're tying it together.
In that particular case, had the potential juror indicated on his questionnaire that he had no contact?
No, he did not show anywhere on his juror questionnaire that he had anything. And again, what they do is they minimize it. Well, if I wasn't convicted, then I guess I'm still innocent.
Right. They start parsing the questions, right?
Right. But it was still on his record that there was a domestic violence injunction filed, but it wasn't that he wasn't charged with any domestic violence. So that was what created the stimulus. But the fact that he wasn't really forthright in it is telling you something about him. It's telling that he's, unless you're asked that a particular question, he's not going to answer it the way you would expect him to be forthright. I mean, he's withholding information, but you could see in his demeanor, which was really important, because this happened to be a murder case that involved domestic violence. So it was very important that we were to sift out any jurors that had any background or domestic violence background.
You know, growing up, I can remember my as a police officer, I never got called for jury duty. And if I did, I never even got past the initial mm-hmm. accidental mailing me something in the mail, because we would never qualify for obvious reasons on a criminal jury while you're a police officer. And I can remember growing up, my father, who was in construction, would often get the request to be summoned for jury duty. And he would do absolutely everything he possibly could to try to get out of being on the jury, especially in big cases where you might be sequestered for a substantial period of time, or you anticipated that. But in today's world, I would assume there are people that actually try to insert themselves into these high profile cases because they're looking for either a book deal, or they want to get on television, or they want to start a podcast. You also have to be cognizant of the folks that are lying, not necessarily because they want to hide something in their background, but they're lying because they're trying to maybe respond in what they think would be the appropriate answers because they want to be on the jury. It has nothing to do with their civic duty or wanting to do the quote unquote the right thing. They just want to get on the case because they're looking at possibly a payday or something down the line as a result of what they're going to experience during the jury process.
Yes. And that's, you know, that's one of the things that we look for too, is that why are they so anxious? You know, they're all of a sudden their calendar's wide open. They don't have
no conflicts,
issues with
no conflicts, right?
No conflict whatsoever. You know, they've got five kids, but no big deal. I can get a babysitter. And, you know, it's just when you know that something is off, there's usually something that's off. And those that are taking all kinds of feverish notes, you know, they're really intense, wanting to get as much information as they can. Those that are kind of leaning in seem to be really super anxious. We got to find out why, you know, why is that? So that's where it's really important to be able to ask the right probative questions, to be able to dig a little bit deeper to find out what they're thinking, what they're feeling, what their motive is, what their intent is, because you nailed it. And especially like in the Casey Anthony case and the George Zimmerman, which I sat through the entire trial and reporting on it throughout. And it's like, which jurors are more apt to look at this as kind of being a payday at the end? And I remember distinctly in the Casey Anthony trial, watching who I knew would be the foreperson, and he was a coach, high school coach. He was leaning in. He was so interested. And during the whole time, he's looking up to the second layer in the courtroom, and that's where we were, the whole media. I mean, you had everybody there from Geraldo to Nancy Grace to Inside Edition 2020. Everybody was there. Anybody that was anybody was up there in the second tier. So he was leaning forward because he was trying to make it, to bring attention to himself. Like, I want to stand out amongst everyone else. And he was looking up constantly to try to make eye contact. So these are the things that we look for. Why is this person so interested and excited about being on this jury? And we do know that they do, a lot of jurors have written books afterwards. And they, you know, we've got reporters and book publishers that are looking for people just like them to be able to tell the story from inside the courtroom.
Do you see an increase in that sort of activity? I mean, do you see more and more people, and especially on the high profile cases where they're trying to insert themselves into the process for those reasons?
I think that pretrial publicity is huge right now, because right now everything is through social media and in the courtroom. Like, it used to be in-session court TV. Now we've got HLN and we've got court TV now that is now back on air again. And, you know, anytime there's a case, since a case has been sensationalized, everybody knows it across the nation. So it doesn't take very long for everybody to find out what's going on. So that also runs into an issue with trying to find a juror that hasn't been already tainted or formed an opinion based on pretrial publicity. So that's been a real problem for attorneys, because we've had to go through a lot of jurors, potential jurors, just because they've already formed an opinion. They're already biased because of social media and so forth. So yes, social media and just media in general has caused a real havoc in the courtroom and for those crime stories enthusiasts.
It's almost impossible in today's world to be involved in any sort of court case where you haven't seen or heard of the case ahead of time. As you said, either through social media or just a 24-hour news cycle, it's next to impossible. If somebody says, you know, I've never heard of this case, and it's in the same general geographic area, I guess you would then question whether that person is being truthful with you, because it's so hard to find somebody who doesn't hear about cases today. It's next to impossible. Yeah. Even if you try to avoid them, you're still going to be exposed in one way or another.
But social media can also be used against them, because it just takes just a couple clicks away and we can right there in the courtroom find out everything that you've been blogging and writing and photographs and everything else. The evidence is all out there. So social media also puts them in a precarious position as well, because we can get to know them pretty well without them even saying a word.
Sure. I guess you could see the other people they follow, the groups they're part of. You can draw a general, I guess, analysis or opinion of where that person stands, either politically or, you know, death penalty case, what their thoughts may be. And if they tell you one thing, but their experience or what they're blogging or tweeting or viewing is another, then obviously there's some sort of deception there or potential deception.
Right. Well, let's just kind of like look at the scenario now. Imagine the Floyd case that's going to be coming up, right? Police officer on this, which really threw this whole big Black Lives Matter into a whippoorwill spin. Imagine the pretrial publicity with that in trying to find anyone on a jury that could be a fair and impartial juror for the defendant. It's just going to be literally impossible, because everyone has already convicted them. So it's going to be, publicity, pretrial publicity is a real problem. And because that is a big international case, it's going to take weeks to be able to find a jury for that case.
As a professional investigator, when we work criminal defense work, one of the things we often are called upon is to review a video statement maybe provided by a witness or a victim or somebody involved in a case. Can you have the same success watching or viewing a video opposed to a person in real life, but a live situation compared to maybe watching a video of a tape statement of somebody in an interview room?
You know, in an interview room, if it's good footage, I mean, clear footage, you can see quite well. And most of my work is in video footage. Not very often am I face to face with alleged perpetrator during the investigation. But there's such great footage right now, and the way that an investigative room is set up, and you're removing all those barriers, you can see them from head to toe. Different from in a courtroom, because you're only seeing them from the waist on up. So it's great to be able to see with video footage from head to toe, because when asked specific questions, we're looking for any sort of things that are off from their baseline demeanor to find pockets of where a person may be being deceptive. So video analysis is very, very important. And not only that, because of the technology that I patent, that we know what emotions, you know, with contempt and anger, fear expressions also are connected with deceptiveness. And the technology, if you've got a great frontage, good read on them, the camera will be able to pick up and then report every emotion that that subject is displaying on their face while the question is being asked. So there's, it's kind of a two-part thing. You know, it's your own subjective analysis, head-to-toe analysis using deceptive deception techniques, and then now since technology has come so far, the jury lab picks up the emotions, and we can see why is that person showing that fear response? Why is that that person smirking? You know, that's smirking, we call it duping delight, when it was inappropriate, or why are they not showing the certain right amount of emotion when they're talking about very sensitive issues? So we've come so far. You know, we've taken what we've learned in the field, that we've vetted in the field, and now we can actually build technologies around it that can do part of our work, too, to make things simpler and also add more objectivity to it, not just subjectivity. Because subjectivity, as you know, can be skewed based on your own personal biases, and that can happen to any of us, whether you're an investigator, a human behavior expert, an attorney, a judge, any of us. Sometimes we can be skewed by our own past experiences as well.
Susan, I'm guessing that there's pluses and there's minuses. I mean, with the use of video, I'm assuming the plus would be you could probably watch that video over and over and over and over again.
Yes.
Whereas in person, obviously, it's you get to see it one time and that's probably it. But I also see the benefit of that in-person review of that person's body language. I don't think there's really, for actually seeing somebody in person and experiencing it in person, although I see how being able to watch the video, and I've done it often in a criminal defense work where I'll watch the same interview four or five times, and every time you sort of, you may pick up on something different. Do you prefer the video review or the in-person? What is your personal preference? Where do you think you have more success?
I don't have a preference for one over the other. I haven't found that one helped me any more than the other. I think that for my analysis, because I'm looking at these very micro movements, even though I saw them if I were face-to-face with them, I would never be able to go back and review that again to make sure I was correct. So I think that by having the video, for me, would be a stronger way for me to detect deception, because I can go back over and over and over and over it again and slow the video down and look at the micro expressions and then have the text right beside me to see exactly what they're saying that causes stimulus. Now, when you're face-to-face, what you do have is the authenticity. You're like in the moment, right? You can feel the energy in the room. You can hear the tone of the voice more clearly. It's this real, you know, authentic face-to-face communication, and you can pick up on those clues. But on the other hand, you don't have anything to go back and review unless it is videotaped. So, you know, it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. But for me, I would say in my work, I like the video analysis stronger than even face-to-face so that I can go back and review it multiple times.
We're speaking with Susan Constantine today, the leading expert and the person to speak to in reference to detecting deceptive behavior. And Susan, I don't want to give it all away, because we're going to, at the end of the show, in our show notes, we'll have the links where folks can go to your website and they can purchase your books and visit your website and get on your mailing list. But can you give us some examples of maybe some of those expressions or micro expressions or some things that you would recommend that maybe as a professional investigator, when I'm out in the field interviewing someone, that I can key in on, that I'm looking for some sort of deception or things I could look for that may help me determine whether that person is being truthful or trying to mislead me?
The number one thing that I always is my backup. This is like the thing that I really go back to and look at the most is there emotional affect right? Is there something off about it? That's the number one. Like, are the responses genuine? Are they delayed? Are the expressions candid? Are they Are they phony? You know, does the emotion, does it tie into what they're saying? Is it consistent or is there a disconnect? That's the number one thing. Then I'm looking at how long it's taking them to answer the question. You know, are they looking up? Are they just trying to pull the, you know, something out of the air? Are they shoulder shrugging? We find that those little micro shoulder shrugs on one side of the shoulder versus the other one. And they're not with, I don't know. They're coming after a statement. They're talking about what they know, and they're you see one shoulder slightly shrugging. That's a huge indicator of deception. And based on Dr. Paul Ekman's work, we found that that cancels out the words that they've said. The other thing as I look for is the expression of the way I'm trying to explain here is they don't really believe they don't believe their own words. It's like it's not confusion. It's they're both of the corners of their mouths turned down, like they're uncertain. And so when they say something with such conviction, and then followed by that is an expression of both corners of the mouth turned down and uncertainty, that's telling me that they're being deceptive. As you know, there's multiple indicators, but the most important thing is that they have to happen in clusters. So, you know, kind of walking through how to detect deception, I think most investigators already know we have to build rapport, remove all the barriers in the room, and ask some inquiring questions so that we can kind of get a good take on them without asking anything probative that would increase anxiety. And then once you've kind of created their baseline, then you're doing a scan. I call it the hands, fingers, knees, and toes, you know, from top to bottom. You're scanning them. See how they're responding in non-threatening questions. Then when you start asking more probative questions, where you suspect that there's deception, but they don't know that you are suspecting there's deception. And then you start to see changes in their demeanor. And it could be anything off from their baseline, because everyone lies differently. There's no formula of a liar from one to the next. It's just a combination of things that happen. So one person may, you ask a probative question, they are trying to tell a story that's different from what they know. It creates what we call cognitive load, meaning I have to tell the story differently from what I've experienced. That creates more taxing on the brain. And when that happens, then they start shifting, moving, licking their lips. They could be rolling their tongue around inside their mouth. They could be leaning forward, leaning back, going to the side, shrugging. There's no one indicator of deception, rather than looking at pockets of different movements off from their baseline when you ask a stimulus question. So that's really the key. You know, if somebody says, oh, well, they just scratched their nose, that's really not good enough, because people could just scratch their nose because their nose needs to be itched. Or they may just, you know, cross their arms, but everything else remains the same. So one clue is not enough. When you start to see them happen in 2s, 3s, and 4s, and they happen within a 5-second period time when you ask a probative question, then now we know that there's anxiety there. So then that's where the investigator needs to probe around like a shark and start asking questions around that pocket of area. I call it like bracketing out that specific area, because we know that's creating a stimulus. We don't know why. We just know that it does, because we can see all of these multiple indicators are deceptive indicators. And that's how you look for deception. And then you've got language, and then there's voice stress analysis, which we can also touch on.
You know, as a police officer, I think the vast majority of our listeners are professional investigators, and overwhelmingly mm-hmm. the number of professional investigators come from a background in law enforcement or military. And most of us, it's a second career sort of thing. So a lot of us bring a world of experience, you know, real world experience dealing with bad guys and doing lots of criminal interviews, and whether we've been trained or we just learned that from being on the street all those years. We bring a lot of that sense of being able to detect this sort of thing, body language and whether someone's being truthful just from speaking with them. Early on in my career, you know, when you're dealing with street level crime and you're generally doing investigations on a street corner, you know, taking statements, talking to victims and witnesses, you sort of have to do it all yourself. I mean, I've got to make sure the person try to see if they're being truthful. I've got to look for the body language. I got to make sure that they're not setting themselves up to assault me. And still watch who's behind me. There's a lot going on there. Later on in your career, you know, when I became a detective, we started doing interviews in a more controlled setting, whether it's in a police station, an interview room later on when we started to develop those. And we had the ability to do like team interviews where one person would be asking the questions and the other would be doing the observation. And then there may be a whole separate room with three and four other investigators watching on a video system. And we'd be able to pick up a whole lot more if we were just doing it ourselves. Do you ever have the opportunity or would you recommend like a team approach to some of these? Or do you always feel it's better to operate on your own so you're just drawing your own conclusions?
Well, I don't quite do it the same way you do, but I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. I think that's a great way of doing it if you have the manpower to do it. Certainly more eyes are able to see things that other people do not. So I think that team effort is great because one human being cannot pick up on all of these micro movements, but maybe others will pick up on things that others didn't see. So I think that that's a really great team approach. My team approach is a little bit differently in my work because since I'm not generally face-to-face, it's usually an attorney or a government agency sending me video to analyze. Then I can then bring on my team members, which is I do the behavioral analysis. I also use the jury lab to analyze their emotional output. Then I've got my statement analysis expert and then the voice stress analysis. So, for example, that's our three-pronged approach. So it's a little bit differently because what you're working on is you're right there in the moment, which is great. You're right there in the moment and you've got different people observing, making notes, and then comparing notes afterwards. In my world, because I'm not an investigator and I'm not a police officer or have any police officer background, you know, mine is in behavioral analysis. I do everything most of it outside of that in that investigation room. So with what I am sent is to observe the behaviors of a person in a deposition or in a police interview, and then I bring on my team and say, okay, I want you to do the statement analysis. Here's the other areas I want you to do voice stress analysis on. And then I don't want to know what you're thinking or feeling or observing. I want to be three complete, clean observations because it is my personal opinion that if a person, you see deceptiveness in their body language, you're going to pick it up on their voice and you're also going to hear it in their, you're going to see it in their language. They all should marry one another. And for unless you have a transcript in front of you, you're going back able to so quickly do the analysis or have the opportunity to do voice stress analysis right there in the room, you know, everything is on the fly. So you're going by that, what you're talking about, that gut reaction, things you've learned from in the past, your experiences, all that's playing, which is very valuable. I'm not taking away that's what you guys have done. You've gotten really good at it. And there's nothing better than that. But for my work, because I'm not doing what you're doing, I have the other ways of detecting deception in an individual outside of that investigative room being there in person.
We're going to go to a break in a few minutes. And when we come back from our break, Susan's going to give us, and I can't wait for this part of the show, Susan's going to give us some examples and analysis of some real cases that we're probably all familiar with. But before we go to break, Susan, you had mentioned the three-prong test. And if you can you just touch on that again and explain how professionals can use that three-prong test and what is available to us?
Sure. So the three-prong test is behavioral analysis. Just one person specializes just in the behavioral analysis, observing the behavior of the subject. Then the voice stress analysis, which is a separate analysis, is usually with a CSVA machine, okay? And that's another individual that takes the investigative tapes and then looks for areas of deceptiveness in the voice. The other person on my team takes what was spoken during the interview, transcribed into a transcript, and then analyzes that transcript to find deceptive indicators. When you take all those three and bring them together, my observations, when I see clusters or pockets of deception, you should be able to see that in their voice and also in the language. For example, would be in their behavior, they're shifting, they're moving, there's an anchor shift, they are looking around trying to pull something from the air, they're licking their lips, they're shrugging their shoulders. I'm using that as an example. Then in the language, there's ands, ums, pauses, changes in vocabulary, there's references, there's time references that are concerning. So let's just look at those areas of in statement analysis. And then voice stress analysis, when the subject is talking about those events, you would see these spikes, Christmas tree spikes, of deceptiveness in their voice. You bring them all together, and then you now have a three-pronged test. Where the person was showing deception in their demeanor, it was found in the language, and it was also found on the voice stress analysis machine.
Do you ever look or seek out some other video of that person or audio to maybe like establish for a layman's term, like a baseline of maybe that he or she always uses that sort of language or the inflection, or they've got that, you know, that twitch when they're sitting there speaking, or do you ever look for like something to establish a baseline or a comparison?
Yes, I do. And if it's available, it's not always available, but I go online and I search around for videos. And I'll talk a little bit about this in after a break about one of the cases I worked on. Actually, two: the Michael Jackson case and then the Elizabeth Holmes case. And but yes, I went on and grabbed other videos to find their baseline in an environment where they're not being questioned or investigated, and then use that also as a comparison. So I've looked at multiple videos in different environments, and then comparing it to the investigation interview tape, also taking into consideration that if a person doesn't feel comfortable being investigated, they're going to show anxiety anyway, which would be considered being normal because of the environment. You have to kind of rule that out. So, you know, you're looking at a wealth of information before you come to your hypothesis. It's not a quick judgment. It takes really a lot of skill and going back and checking other ways of detecting deception to make sure that when you make an analysis, you should be pretty darn certain that that person is being deceptive. So I'm very careful with that. I mean, I don't want to call out people when I don't know for a fact that they're lying. I mean, that's the worst thing you can do.
Sure.
So it's important to do your homework ahead of time before you start making any sort of analysis about somebody.
We're going to hop out and take a quick break right now. When we come back, Susan's going to give us some examples of some real-world analysis that she's done. Hold on, everyone, through the break.
This episode is brought to you by PI Magazine, the most respected voice of the professional investigator, featuring stories and articles on current topics, equipment reviews, marketing tips, and investigative advice for the professional investigator. Don't miss a single issue of PI Magazine. Visit PIMagazine.com and subscribe today. PI Directory, the go-to directory for the professional investigator. List your agency today and detail your investigative specialties and coverage areas. PIDirectory.com. Get your listing today. Go to PIDirectory.com. PI Gear. For all your professional investigator equipment needs, go to PIGear.com. Professional grade equipment and advice for real surveillance experts and professional investigators. Visit PIGear.com. PI Gear, where the pros shop. Now back to our hosts, Jim Nanos and Nicole Cusinelli.
And welcome back, everyone, to PI Magazine, a podcast. We're speaking today with Susan Constantine. Susan is widely recognized as the world's leading authority on body language as it pertains to deception detection. Before we went out on break, you had teased us a little bit with telling us about some of the cases you've worked on. And this is, I'm so excited about this part of the show because this is really the stuff that I love to hear about. Can you give us some examples of some real world cases to the extent that you're able to discuss them? Some of the cases you've worked on and did some analysis on that maybe folks would be familiar with.
Okay, so cases that I've worked on as being hired by the defense or by the state, one of them was the Michael Jackson case, the most recent one. Then the Dahlia DiPolito case that was here in Florida a couple years ago. She was it was a hit for hire case, and you saw it on the cop TV show. And then others, there were several other ones, but I'm going to talk about the George Zimmerman and the Casey Anthony trial, because even though I wasn't hired for those cases, I was the media analyst. So in other words, I was used as an in-courtroom reporter on what was happening in the courtroom based on demeanor evidence of everything that was going on in those two cases. So I'd love to talk about those because those are actually very interesting cases, and to point out some specific things that I thought were very interesting.
The microphone is yours. So, please go ahead, because I'm so excited to hear about these cases. Okay. I love they're all cases I loved to follow and paid a lot of attention to, and I think a lot of our listeners probably have also.
Okay. So, I mean, have you ever seen the movie called The Inventor?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So that was Elizabeth Holmes. She was the one that developed this blood testing device that she stated was through a prick of blood that you'd be able to detect all of these possible genetic disformities or something in their blood. And so
she was going to put them out in like all CVS's or Walgreens, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was Walgreens.
Right.
And she had big time, big money behind her that invested in it. So what happened with that case was really interesting, because I was brought on that case by a person that she was, I'm not going to name the name because it's just to protect the client, but was being sued by Elizabeth Holmes because she said that he had stolen her copyright of this blood testing device. So anyway, he just could not get a good take on her. So there's just something not quite right with her. I don't know what it is. So I said, well, send me some videos. So she had done a lot of videos with her speaking in front of distinguished groups, you know, medical groups and, big name. I wish I knew all the names of them. I don't, because it's been a little while, but they were all big name people that were in the medical field that she was speaking to. And she, remember now, back then, she was a young girl. She was like in her early 20s. She had dropped out of college and because everybody thought she was so brilliant that she came up with this amazing idea that even one of the professors quit teaching and then jumped on her team to become one of the scientists. So she was able to captivate people's interest, and a lot of money was thrown her way. So during this lawsuit, I was called by a defendant in the case and asked me to evaluate her videos, her speaking in front of all these different conference groups. And so I had several different videos to look at just to kind of get her baseline, to get her demeanor, kind of get to know her a little bit more and so forth. And then there was a video of where she's talking about the device and how it works. And there was a moment of where she is talking about what the efficacy, what the of this product, and how well it works. And at that moment, she's talking, she uses a bolstering word, and she uses a word like we're extremely confident that. And when she does that, she bolstered it, first of all, in her language, but then her hand came up and started to rub on her neck. So anytime a female rubs their hand on their neck, that's usually concern, worry, weakness, and her hand gestures were not very confident. Her language was not confident. and her facial expression showed a marked expression of fear and then sadness. There was some that was kind of interesting mix. So now let's go fast forward. This movie comes this movie's got about ready to come out, and I get an email from the client and says, "Hey, did you happen to see the cover of Fortune 500 or some big magazine out there?" And said that, you know, she was being accused of being a fraud. And I was like, wow, okay, that's kind of interesting. Well, I decided I'm going to go back. Let me go back and review those tapes back in 2013. Let me see what I could find. And when I found that pocket in there of where she was uncertain about her own product, I went back and looked at the report and said, she doesn't even believe her own product can do what she says it's going to do. She doesn't believe in her own product. Well, coming forward now, that's exactly what happened. She was not confident that her product was going to do what they said it was going to do, and it didn't. So you could see it in her demeanor. You saw it in her voice. You saw it in her language, all in one cluster within a 5-second period. It's brilliant. So that I thought was pretty cool, because that was before I even had the Jury Lab technology and used it on the video when I went to go back and reanalyze it. But just in the demeanor evidence was like she just wasn't certain that this was going to work. And I had no idea. I thought that she had gone on and was very successful and opened up this big company and everything else, and come to find out that she was a fraud and it didn't work. And I'm like, I got the phone call back and said, you know what? You nailed it. you just nailed it. And I was like, wow, that is so cool. Cause it's a beautiful thing when it pulls all together like that, you know? So, and then another case that I recently worked on was the Michael Jackson case, which has to do with the two subjects that said that they were sexually molested by Michael Jackson, and the two guys, Wade Robson and James Safechuck, had made allegations about sexual molestation at the Neverland Ranch. And so I had a video to analyze and depositions, tapes, and et cetera, to see how these guys lying and telling the truth, what's going on here. And I had gone through and looked at other videos, you know, when they were in other environments. So, you know, there was a collection of videos that I looked at just kind of get their baseline and so forth before I started my analysis. And what I found was that after I was analyzing all of the videotapes was that there was something that was very unusual when they were being deposed. Is that in the language and in the voice stress analysis, there were multiple areas of deceptive indicators. So the question is, did it happen? Well, you know, no one really knows, did it really happen, except for those two and Michael, who is no longer alive. But there were so many areas within the deposition where they bolstered and fabricated the stories so much bigger than what they were. So it was throwing off everything. It was throwing off their language. There was deceptive indicators in their voice stress analysis. You could see it in their demeanor, the lack of emotional affect when they're talking about the alleged abuses. There was no pain. There was no suffering. There was no sadness. There was this very flat affect. It was through a 7-hour deposition tape. There were so many areas throughout it that were just saying, I was just calling BS on it. I was like, okay, this is just not the way it happened. It was like taking the truth and telling it falsely. So then you have to wonder, did these incidents happen? And I'm not saying that it did or it didn't happen. I'm just saying that there was so much fabrication in their stories by bolstering that you would have to go back and go, why would one have to bolster and fabricate so much of the information? Well, the reason why, as you think about it, go back to the case and you're going, okay, well, they're suing the estate. So they're suing the estate. So I guess their way of thinking was, if I can make this story even bigger and more atrocious than ever, then there would be a bigger payoff at the end. So that's what stake was involved there. So, we did that analysis, a three-pronged analysis, gave it to the attorneys because there was this documentary that was coming out, the Neverland 1 and 2, and hopefully we'd be able to bring some evidence to say, hey, these guys are not being completely truthful. And so, you know, I think that that's important for the public to know, the family to know. I think, you know, if it happened, it happened. But if it didn't happen the way they're saying it's happened, then that should be put through the test. So that took multiple weeks to do. That was not an easy task. And but we did finish it and provide the results of it. And our overall analysis was that we don't believe that it necessarily didn't happen, but it didn't happen to the extent or to the magnitude and the description in which they described.
Well, how about the Casey Anthony case is one that we all, I mean, I don't know anyone who doesn't, yes, hasn't followed that case or at least knows something about it. What's your take, yes, on that?
Okay, well, I'm going to bring you to one part that did it for me, okay? Because each one of these cases, there's certain parts that says, okay, that was my slam, that was my Shaquille and O'Neal moment. And during the Casey Anthony trial, there was a moment where there was an expert, human decomposition expert, that was testifying regarding the odor in the back of the trunk. And when he was describing this odor, Casey, I happened to look right over. I was literally within like one or two rows behind her, and I looked right over at her, and she showed a micro expression of disgust. And I thought, whoa, that was really interesting, because if you were hearing from a mother about the smell of human decomposition, who is allegedly your daughter, what would be to you the emotion that you would expect her to show?
I wouldn't expect disgust. Sadness, horror, everything but disgust. That's sort of a pedestrian view of it, opposed to someone who, that's my child.
Correct. And you are right on point. So that's saying to me, as the evaluator, she was recalling that odor. So she had a moment where she was recalling that moment, opening up that trunk and smelling that humid decomposition. It created a disgust response simultaneously as the witness was testifying regarding when that trunk first opened up, that he smelled the human remains of human decomposition.
I completely understand where you're going with that now. I wasn't thinking of that. I was thinking more, mm-hmm, of the disgust. I never even thought about her actually reliving the odor.
Reliving it.
Right. I didn't think about, yes, it that way. But when you say that, it, yes, makes perfect sense. It absolutely makes sense. Sure.
Exactly. So, you know, when you see that response, you would have expected horror, fear. She would have been crying. She would have been devastated. It would have been too much for her, because just the thinking that her daughter, the one she loved so much, to smelling this god-awful human decomposition odor, disgust is the last thing that you would have experienced from a mother. That, to me, was the one that really did it for me. Plus, there were so many moments during the trial where there's a Casey Anthony on the camera and there's a Casey Anthony off the camera. Off the camera, she's smirking, she's doing the Bambi eye, she's smiling, she's, you know, laughing, she loves to connect with people through her physical attractiveness. You know, she loves to allure people, and that was very obvious when the cameras were off. But then when the camera's on, she was able to kind of detach from her emotions, and she had that very flat, non-expressionless appearance, which for many was so disturbing because she just didn't show any real emotion. But I think that in that case, what was interesting about that is that the defense had her face directly in front of, which is the courtroom was set up a little bit different. The courtroom was set up to where the jury was faced directly in front of the defense table. where she was seated. So there was that sense of familiarity of where they're looking at Casey day in and day out. It's not like they're having to look off to the right where normally the where the defendant would be seated, but directly in front. So there was that connectiveness, a likability factor that was happening throughout the trial. And then we had the basketball guy who was telling me about the foreperson who was leaning up, looking up into the stands, trying to gather the attention of, you know, Judge Jeanine and Nancy Grace and all of them, you know, obviously an attention seeker. But I think in that particular case that they looked at Casey as she was a liar. So the fact that she lied about so many different things, the nanny and everything else, but that was just part of her DNA. And they got very familiar with that and they accepted that. That was just her personality. Losing sight of the fact that there were 61 days where she never reported her daughter missing. So let's forget about that. The logic doesn't make sense. But I think that the defense did a brilliant job in taking the attention away from her and onto her father. And so the father, even though he wasn't being tried, he was really being tried in the public because that's where the attention went, taking all the attention away from Casey. And the other part of it was because there was no physical evidence of her daughter left of the manner of death. They just didn't have anything to hang anything on, and that's why she was found not guilty. But
when they accused the father, did you have any analysis on his reaction and his wife's?
Oh my gosh!
Reaction?
It was horrible. I looked over at George, and I had never seen a person so depleted that literally the soul of that person was completely evaporated. His whole face was just not in anger, just like he was completely evaporated. I don't even know how he was able to even get up and walk. I mean, there was just no life left in him at all. And I personally don't believe that he had anything to do with it. I've spoken to George Anthony. I've spoken to Cindy Anthony at the courthouse when we were there just in conversation. And just watching him throughout the trial, I don't see that he had anything to do with the murder of Kaylee.
Did you pick up any indication that either George or his wife were aware that was going to come out, or was it a blindsided attack on them? They just didn't see it coming.
I think for George it was blindsided, but there, Cindy, on the other hand, you know, she's an interesting gal. You know, watching her over time and then seeing one day where I knew that she was going to, there was something different about her demeanor one day, because usually she would show up in her little flower dresses and she'd be testifying. But then one day she comes in and she's dressed professional. I'm going, she's going to tell some really important information today. And I thought that's because she's like suited up for different.
Dressed for the cameras.
Different. Yeah, she's dressed for the cameras. And that's the day where she says that she was the one that was doing the Google searches for chloroform. And because her dog was sick and that maybe the dog had been eating some of the plants, and it was her that was doing the Google searches and it wasn't Casey's computer. So she was taking the hit for it. But Cindy was is a mom that I think felt very guilty in a lot of ways of that her daughter was capable of doing something like that. But I think that she looked at herself like that was also, people are looking at me. How could I have raised a girl that was capable of doing that? So she was coming to her defense, to actually her own self-protection, defense of her daughter, but her own defense.
It's almost like she's accused by proxy. You accuse my daughter, so therefore you're almost accusing me because I raised my daughter.
Too.
Right.
Right. But she was like a bulldog. There's nothing you could have done or said. There's no question that could have been asked that would get her to get off of her game. She was very good at it, which goes to tell you the apple doesn't fall far, far from the tree.
Right. Susan, can you stay with me just a couple more minutes?
Sure.
How about George Zimmerman?
Okay. Well, one of the things that I think that's really important for an investigator, I think this would be great for any of the investigators that are out there listening to this podcast, to go back and watch the reenactment tape of George Zimmerman as when he's in the car with the investigator, as he's telling the investigator exactly what happened. He's walking the property, but before he's doing that, he's actually in the car and he's telling you what direction that he saw Trayvon Martin, where he went, and then he gets out of the car, and then he walks to the area where he says that Trayvon Martin had confronted him, and then he was smashing his head, you know, on the pavement and so forth. So right at the point where he's talking about where he had, where his head was being beaten, right there on the pavement, you'll notice that he loses his train of thought. He pauses, he hesitates, he stammers a little bit. And then what he does is very interesting. He points to a direction and he makes a gun gesture, okay? So this is what we call an emblem, right? An emblem has a specific meaning based on that gesture. We know one when we see someone's driving down the street and they don't like us very well. We know what that indicator is, right?
I've received that more than once.
Yeah, I have too. But, you know, the thumbs up is like everything's good and thumbs down is bad.
Right.
And, you know, we know what those are what we call emblems. They have a specific meaning. A gun gesture, we know, with a thumb up and the index finger out, with the other three fingers tucked in, is the shape of a gun, correct?
Correct.
So when you go back and watch the reenactment tape, watch when he's in the car and watch his gesturing. Watch to see how he moves his hands. He's very expressive when he's talking, so he's Hispanic, so he tends to use a lot of gesturing. He's very fluid in most of his movements. But then when he gets out of his car, he never makes this gun gesture until he points down this, like, sidewalk area right after he says that he was plummeted by Trayvon Martin. So what did that tell me, okay? All that told me was is that somewhere in his defense, when he was telling, when this story was told, that it happened a little bit differently than what he said it happened, because that's where the gun was pulled out. The gun was now, whether it went back into his holster again, I don't know. But there was a gun pointed at that moment. So the body language doesn't betray you, right? So subconsciously, he made that gesture. It's because he actually physically pulled the gun out then. So I showed that to federal court judges conference, and I was their keynote speaker, and I brought them to that very end, and I stopped the video and I said, that's the gun right there, that's where he pulled it out. And everyone missed it. And one of the judges said, that would have been a great close for a prosecutor right there. That, ladies and gentlemen, is where he pulled the gun. But nobody got it, but it's in there. And I know how savvy your investigators are. They're well trained. Go back through the reenactment tape, and it's towards the very end, you'll see it, and it happens very quickly.
I think a lot of us are conditioned. I know some of the training I've been through is we're so conditioned to listen to and decipher and decode what somebody's saying that we don't pay a lot of attention to how they're saying it or what they're doing mm-hmm. while they're saying it, which people, again, when you're telling a story, you're also thinking about what am I saying, not how I'm saying it.
Right. And see, the other thing is that most people, and when they're lying to too, is they can either pay attention to their demeanor, how they're presenting themselves, or what they're saying.
Can't do it all, though.
They can't do it all.
Right.
And they may do pretty good at first, right? But the longer they talk, the more they're going to hang themselves, and they'll start to get off their game. So what do we want them to do? We want them to continue talking. We want to use what we call minimal encouragers just to kind of get them rolling, keep them talking. The more they talk, the more they're going to reveal themselves. And then you now look for those little pockets of indicators where there's what we call cognitive load. Bracket those out. Don't pay attention to all the truthful stuff, because you know, most of what someone's going to say is going to be truthful. It's in that little bit of the areas where there's untruthful, where they skip over, they minimize, they leave out. That's where the deception is. So the human brain knows where the deception is, so they've got to then create a new narrative. And that seems logical to you. And they skip over stuff so that, because if they were talking about it as it were to happen, they know that they would give away a lot of clues of deception. But you're absolutely correct. They can either pay attention to what they're doing or what they're saying, but they can't do both at the same time.
Not over an extended period of time.
Nope.
Wow. Susan, this has been fascinating today. Tell our listeners how they can get a hold of you and where they can visit you at your website and get on your mailing list, because I'm on your mailing list and I love the stuff I get from you. I read every single bit of it.
Excellent. So they can go right to the Human Behavior Lab. It's www.T and then the word human, HUMANBL as in behavior lab.com, or just go into the humanbehaviorlab.com. My email address, you can email me directly to my personal email address, which is Susan@silentmessages, and that's plural.com. And if you're interested in the technology, that is the Jury Lab. That's www.thejurylab.com. All the information about deception detection services are going to be found on the Human Behavior Lab website. On the technology side, there's a separate whole entity, and that's not a deception device. It's really designed more for mock trials and focus groups.
We're going to wrap up this episode of PI Magazine, a podcast. I'd like to thank our guest, Susan Constantine, for a really great show, my co-host, Nicole Cusinelli, and board operator, Detective Jack Russell. Remember to visit PIMagazine.com and PI Gear and support the advertisers and friends who support our profession. Join us next week for another episode of PI Magazine, the podcast. I'm your host, Jim Nanos, and until then, remember, stay professional and keep investigating.
Thank you for joining us in this episode of PI Magazine, the podcast. Join us next week for a new and exciting show with your hosts and the publishers of PI Magazine, Jim Nanos and Nicole Cusinelli. Remember to check out our guests and sponsors' websites to support those who support our profession. Visit PIMagazine.com for the latest links, conference updates, and professional news, and subscribe today. Thank you again, and remember, keep investigating.